Hey there, curious minds. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is, well, it's to unpack the really complex world of macroeconomic policy. You know, how governments and central banks try to steer an economy, keep things stable, and the surprising challenges they bump into along the way. We've got a fascinating stack of sources here that explore all the different policy tools and how effective they really are. Things like hitting targets for full employment, stable prices, decent economic growth, and keeping international payments balanced. We'll be diving into the big categories: fiscal, monetary, supply side, exchange rate, and international trade policies. But it's not just about defining, right? It's about how well they actually work in the real world, and the conflicts that pop up when you're chasing multiple goals at once, even the chance of what economists call government failure. Okay, let's get into it and unpack the fascinating details of economic management.
Absolutely. And adding to that, our goal is really to help you, the listener, get a better feel for judging real-world economic management. It's about appreciating the huge challenges policymakers are up against when they try to hit all these targets at the same time. It really is a delicate balancing act, and our sources definitely highlight just how complex that gets.
Totally agree. So yeah. Let's kick things off with maybe the biggest, most direct tool governments have. Fiscal policy. Fundamentally, what are we talking about here? What does it involve?
Okay, so at its core, fiscal policy means deliberate changes in government spending and taxation. The main goal is to influence the overall level of demand in the economy, aggregate demand, trying to steer it where you want it to go.
Right, and it sounds like it hits quite a few of those key macroeconomic goals we mentioned. What are its main aims, according to what we've read?
Oh, it's pretty broad. For instance, it can directly tackle unemployment. You know, through more public spending on projects or services, which creates jobs. It's also really important for economic growth, especially when the government invests in things like long-term infrastructure that boosts the economy's capacity. And it can be used against inflation, too. Like, higher taxes can reduce how much money people have to spend, cooling down demand and prices. And crucially, it's a big tool for income redistribution, using progressive taxes and welfare payments to try and reduce inequality.
Okay, that makes sense in theory. But when does fiscal policy really work best in practice? Are there specific situations where it's like extra powerful?
Yeah, definitely. Fiscal policy can have a really high multiplier effect, especially during recessions. What that means is a certain amount of government spending or a tax cut can actually lead to a much bigger increase in overall economic activity. It's like a ripple effect. It's also super effective in what's called a liquidity trap. That's a rare situation, but important. It's where monetary policy kind of stops working because interest rates are already rock bottom, maybe even zero. People just hoard cash instead of spending or investing, so cutting rates further does nothing. In those cases, direct government spending is often the only game in town to boost demand. Plus, you can directly target public services or infrastructure where it's needed most.
Okay, so if it's that powerful, there must be some serious drawbacks too, right? This is where it gets really interesting. What are the big hurdles?
Oh, for sure. One massive challenge is time lags. There's the recognition lag, just figuring out there's a problem. Then a decision lag, getting the policy actually approved, which can take ages in politics. And finally, an implementation lag, the time it takes for the policy to actually kick in and have an effect. These lags mean a policy made for today's problem might only hit the economy months, maybe even a year later, when things could be totally different. It can also obviously lead to higher public debt if you're not careful. That's a long-term headache. And then there's this really key idea of crowding out.
Crowding out. That sounds like a technical term for something maybe straightforward. Can you break that down?
Yeah, absolutely. Crowding out happens when the government borrows a lot of money to fund its spending. This increases the demand for loanable funds, potentially pushing up interest rates. And when interest rates go up, it gets more expensive for private companies to borrow money for their own investments. So the government borrowing kind of crowds out or reduces that private investment. The government's effort to boost the economy might accidentally stifle the private sector a bit. It's a big debate point around deficits. And speaking of taxes, the Laffer curve also comes up in our source material. It's this interesting idea. It suggests the relationship between tax rates and tax revenue isn't linear, it's a curve. The idea is, after a certain point, raising tax rates even higher could actually reduce the total tax money the government collects.
How does that work?
Well, the theory is that super high taxes discourage people from working or investing, or they might find ways to avoid the tax, maybe even leave. So the economic activity that gets taxed shrinks and total revenue falls. It was a big idea for supply-siders, you know, back in the Reagan and Thatcher days.
Interesting. even if how much it applies in practice is debated.
Exactly. It shows how economic theory can sometimes lead to surprising, maybe counterintuitive policy ideas.
Fascinating stuff on the government's direct financial power. But then you've got the central bank operating with a different, maybe more subtle, toolkit. Let's pivot to monetary policy. What's the central bank doing here?
Right, so monetary policy is mainly about using interest rates and controlling the amount of money circulating in the economy. The central bank does this primarily to influence inflation, but also consumption and investment levels across the whole economy.
Okay, and how does that toolkit impact those same big objectives, like growth and inflation?
Well, for inflation, it's pretty direct. If inflation is too high, the central bank raises interest rates. That makes borrowing more expensive, so people and businesses spend less, which cools down those price pressures.
And for growth?
Lowering interest rates does the opposite. It makes borrowing cheaper, which hopefully encourages businesses to invest and households to consume more, stimulating growth. And it has a big effect on the exchange rate, too. Interest rate differences between countries attract international money flows, and that pushes the currency's value up or down.
What makes monetary policy often the first port of call? When is it particularly effective?
Well, a big advantage is flexibility and speed. Central banks can often change interest rates much faster than governments can pass spending bills, sometimes overnight. And central bank independence, being separate from day-to-day politics, helps with credibility. Their decisions are often seen as more focused on the economy, less on upcoming elections.
Right.
And it's pretty good for, like, fine-tuning, making smaller adjustments rather than massive fiscal programs.
But same question as before. It's not a magic bullet, is it? What holds monetary policy back?
Definitely not a magic bullet. It can be much less effective if consumer or business confidence is really low. People might just not want to borrow or spend, no matter how cheap it is. Or again, in that liquidity trap situation we mentioned. If rates are already near zero, cutting them further doesn't do much.
Okay.
Also, the transmission mechanism, how rate changes actually filter through the banks, affect lending, asset prices, confidence, and eventually spending, that can be slow and uncertain. You don't always know exactly how or when it will hit.
Right, unpredictable.
Yeah. And of course, higher interest rates, while fighting inflation, can also dampen important business investment and activity. So there's that trade-off again.
Which brings us nicely to another angle, supply-side policies. These sound different, less about managing immediate demand, more about the economy's fundamental engine, its long-term capacity. What's the core idea?
Exactly right. Supply-side policies are all about increasing the economy's potential to produce goods and services. It's about making the economy more efficient, more flexible, more competitive. Improving how it works from the ground up, focusing on the supply side, not just demand.
And our sources mentioned a couple of different flavors of these policies, didn't they?
Yeah, broadly two types. First, you have market-based policies.
Mm-hmm.
Think deregulation. Tax cuts aim specifically at boosting incentives to work or invest, making labor markets more flexible, maybe easier hiring and firing rules.
Okay.
Then you have interventionist policies. This is where the government gets more directly involved, spending money on things like education, training, building infrastructure, or funding research and development.
So whether it's market-based or interventionist, how do these supply-side policies aim to affect those big economic goals we keep coming back to?
Their main target is long-term economic growth. By expanding what the economy can produce, its potential output, they also aim to lower structural unemployment, the kind that exists even when the economy is doing okay, by making the workforce more skilled and adaptable. Plus, improving trade performance by making domestic industries more competitive internationally. And ideally, they should also lead to more stable prices in the long run, because increased productivity tends to lower production costs per unit.
And their effectiveness seems tied to tackling those deeper underlying issues. What are their main strengths?
That's exactly it. Their strength lies in addressing those fundamental structural problems that can really hold an economy back. Things that just managing demand won't fix. By boosting efficiency and competitiveness, they aim for better long-term economic performance, not just a short-term sugar rush. They're designed to encourage entrepreneurship, innovation, and ideally make the economy less reliant on constant government support by fostering a more dynamic private sector. But, and it's a big but, they have real limitations too. They often take a long time to work and can be expensive up front.
Right. Not a quick fix.
Not at all. Think about reforming the whole education system or building major new transport links. The payoff might be years or even decades down the line. They can also potentially make inequality worse, at least in the short term. For example, some argue certain tax cuts mostly help high earners, or deregulation might weaken worker protections.
I see.
And a really crucial point. They need serious political will and consistency. You need governments to stick with these long-term plans, even when political winds change, which, you know, isn't always easy in democracies.
We've covered domestic tools, but economies don't exist in a vacuum. What happens when we look outwards? That brings us to exchange rate policy. How can a currency's value be used as an economic tool?
Right. Exchange rate policy is about how a country manages its currency's value compared to other currencies, whether they let it float freely, fix it to something else like the dollar, or manage it somewhere in between. The goal is to influence trade flows and international capital movements.
And the sources mentioned different systems. Can you quickly outline those?
Sure. You've got fixed exchange rates, where a country literally pegs its currency's value to another currency, or maybe a basket of currencies. They promise to maintain that rate.
Okay.
Then floating exchange rates, where the market decides, the value goes up and down based purely on supply and demand for the currency.
Like the US dollar or the euro most.
Exactly. And then there's the managed float, which is kind of a hybrid. The rate mostly floats, but the central bank jumps in sometimes to buy or sell its currency to nudge the rate if it moves too far or too fast.
And what are the main economic objectives policymakers are trying to hit with this?
Well, it's key for trying to achieve stability in the balance of payments, the record of all transactions with other countries. It also plays a role in controlling domestic inflation because the exchange rate affects the price of imported goods.
Ah, right.
And of course, it directly impacts export competitiveness. A weaker currency makes your exports cheaper for foreigners.
So how well does it work in achieving those goals?
Well, a weaker currency depreciation makes exports cheaper and imports more expensive. That can boost demand for your country's goods and help shrink a trade deficit.
Makes sense.
On the other hand, fixed rates can bring stability to international trade and investment. Businesses know what the exchange rate will be, which reduces risk. That can be really helpful for long-term planning. But, again, limitations. A weaker currency might be good for exports, but it causes imported inflation because everything you buy from abroad costs more. That pushes up domestic prices.
Yeah, the price at the pump, for example.
Exactly. And maintaining a fixed rate can be really tough. It might force a country to use up its foreign reserves defending the peg, or make big disruptive changes to interest rates that mess up other domestic goals. And floating rates, while flexible, bring their own problems. That volatility can create a lot of uncertainty for businesses involved in international trade or investment. Makes planning harder.
Okay, that leads us to the final policy area, international trade policy. What's this about?
International trade policy covers things governments do to influence the flow of goods and services across their borders. This includes putting up barriers like tariffs, taxes on imports, or quotas limits on the quantity of imports. But also includes things like negotiating trade agreements to reduce barriers. The objectives here can vary quite a bit. Sometimes it's about protecting domestic jobs, using protectionist measures to shield local industries from foreign competition. Other times the goal is economic growth, believing that opening up to trade enhances efficiency and spurs innovation through competition. And it can also tie into the balance of payments, maybe aiming for export-led growth.
And effectiveness. How well does it work?
Well, trade liberalization reducing barriers generally promotes export industries and helps economies integrate globally. It encourages countries to specialize in what they do best, you know, the whole comparative advantage idea. Protectionism, on the other hand, can give temporary shelter to new or struggling domestic industries, maybe allowing them time to grow stronger before facing the full force of global competition, sometimes called the infant industry argument.
But the downside must be significant too. What are the main limitations here?
Oh, absolutely. A huge risk with protectionism is retaliation. If one country puts up tariffs, others often hit back with their own. You can end up in damaging trade wars that hurt everyone.
Yeah, we've seen examples of that.
Exactly. And generally, economists agree that protectionism tends to reduce overall economic efficiency. It limits competition, restricts consumer choice, and often leads to higher prices for everyone. Plus, becoming overly reliant on exports can make an economy vulnerable. If global demand slumps or demand from your main trading partners drops, your whole economy can take a big hit. It increases external risks. And you know what's really fascinating here and comes through strongly in the sources is how these different goals, low unemployment, stable prices, growth, balanced trade, often clash. They're interconnected, sure, but trying to achieve all of them at once often leads to really difficult conflicts and trade-offs. It's rarely a simple case of just pulling one lever.
That's such a critical point. It often gets lost in the headlines, doesn't it? Our sources actually detail several specific conflicts that really drive this home, like the classic one, inflation versus unemployment.
Right, the Phillips curve dilemma. Policies designed to boost the economy and lower unemployment, like cutting interest rates or increasing spending, often risk pushing inflation higher as demand starts to outrun supply. Historically, there seemed to be this inverse relationship, though it's become more complicated over time. But the basic tension remains.
So governments often have to choose which one to prioritize.
Pretty much. Or try to find that incredibly difficult sweet spot. It forces tough choices, often with big political and social consequences.
Then there's the conflict that feels more and more urgent today. Economic growth versus environmental sustainability.
Yes, absolutely. High rates of economic growth, especially if they rely heavily on using up natural resources or polluting industries, can obviously lead to resource depletion and damage the environment. It's a massive challenge for sustainable development. How do you get the economic benefits now without wrecking the planet for the future? A huge balancing act.
And what about trying to get everyone employed versus keeping the balance of payments in check?
Yeah, that's another tricky one. When an economy gets close to full employment, people generally have higher incomes. That's great, but they also tend to spend more.
Including on imported goods.
Exactly. So rising incomes can lead to a surge in imports, which can worsen the country's trade deficit and put pressure on its balance of payments. A strong domestic economy can sometimes create external headaches.
There's also that tension between short-term fixes and long-term goals.
Oh, constantly. Politicians, especially around election time, might be tempted by policies that give a quick, visible boost. Maybe a tax cut that stimulates spending right away. But the downside could be a big increase in government debt that creates problems down the road. Short-term gain, long-term pain, potentially.
And the exchange rate versus inflation conflict we touched on earlier.
Right. Trying to boost exports by letting your currency weaken makes imports more expensive. That directly feeds into domestic inflation, hitting consumers' pockets. So a policy helping exporters might hurt households through higher prices. It's a trade-off central banks wrestle with all the time.
And finally, maybe one of the most politically charged ones. Inequality versus efficiency.
Yes. Policies aimed at reducing income inequality, maybe higher taxes on the rich, more generous welfare benefits, are obviously trying to achieve a fairer society. But some argue these policies might also reduce the incentives for people to work hard, take risks, invest, or start businesses, potentially making the overall economy less dynamic or efficient.
Finding that balance.
Finding that incredibly difficult balance between fairness and economic dynamism is a perennial challenge. So this really raises a crucial question. Given all these inherent conflicts and trade-offs, how do policymakers actually navigate them? There's rarely one right answer. It involves constant monitoring, making difficult compromises, and often accepting that you just can't perfectly hit every single target simultaneously.
Indeed. And that leads us straight into another really interesting, sometimes worrying concept, government failure. So what happens when policies, even with the best intentions, just go wrong? They miss the mark, or maybe even make things worse. What's that look like?
Yeah, government failure is when macroeconomic policies either don't achieve what they set out to do, or worse, they actually lead to a less desirable outcome, maybe due to inefficiencies or unforeseen consequences. It's when the intervention itself causes problems, maybe even bigger problems than the one it was trying to solve. And there are several reasons why this can happen. One big one is just imperfect information. Policymakers might not have accurate data, or they might misjudge things like how much slack there really is in the economy, the output gap, or what people expect inflation to do. Bad data can lead to bad policy.
And those time lags we discussed earlier must be a huge factor here too.
Absolutely. Those implementation lags are a classic cause of failure. By the time a policy designed to cool an overheating economy actually takes effect, the economy might already be slowing falling down.
Making it counterproductive.
Exactly. Can end up destabilizing things further rather than stabilizing them. Then you got political constraints. Let's be realistic. Governments operate in a political world, with elections. This can sometimes lead them to choose policies that are popular in the short term, even if they're not the most economically sound in the long run. Electoral cycles can distort decision making.
And that crowding out effect we talked about with fiscal policy that fits under government failure too, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a perfect example. The government tries to stimulate the economy by borrowing and spending, but an unintended consequence is higher interest rates that reduce private investment. So the policy partly undermines itself. That's a form of failure. Another issue is relying too heavily on just one type of policy. Maybe trying to solve everything with just monetary policy or just fiscal policy without considering supply side reforms or trade issues. Complex problems usually need a mix of tools. Over-reliance on one can lead to imbalances or just be ineffective, like trying to build a house with only a hammer. There's also the risk of misallocating resources. Government subsidies or grants might end up propping up inefficient industries.
Why would that happen?
Well, maybe because those industries have powerful lobbies, or simply because the targeting of the support wasn't very good. The money doesn't go where it would be most productive.
And this often leads to those really visible unintended consequences, where a policy does the exact opposite of what was intended.
Precisely. The sources give classic examples. Rent controls, meant to make housing affordable, can end up reducing the supply and quality of rental housing because landlords have less incentive.
Right.
Or minimum wage laws aimed at helping low-paid workers might, in some circumstances, lead businesses to hire fewer people or invest more in automation, potentially increasing unemployment for some low-skilled groups. And finally, there's a subtle but important one called regulatory capture. This is where the regulatory bodies that are supposed to oversee an industry, maybe banking or energy, end up becoming too close to that industry. They start acting more in the interests of the companies they regulate rather than the broader public interests they were set up to protect.
Wow. Okay, so putting it all together, it's crystal clear that hitting all those macroeconomic goals at the same time is just an immense challenge. It's incredibly complex. We've walked through this diverse toolkit, fiscal, monetary, supply side, exchange rate, trade policies, and seen so many potential pitfalls, from those built-in conflicts between goals to the very real possibility of government failure because of bad information, politics, or just unintended consequences.
That really is the core message coming from our sources. Policy choices aren't made in a vacuum. They have to be grounded in a really clear-eyed understanding of the specific economic situation, the unavoidable trade-offs you're making between different goals, and all the potential ripple effects, good and bad. The sources consistently emphasize that you need a balanced mix of all these different policy types: fiscal, monetary, supply side, exchange rate, trade, to have the best shot at long-term stability and prosperity. No single policy is a silver bullet.
Absolutely. So thinking about all these complexities, this constant juggling act, and the ever-present risk of policies going awry, here's something for you, our listener, to ponder. How does this change the way you look at real-world economic policy debates or decisions? And what deeper questions does it spark for you at that fundamental tension, that balance between government stepping in and letting market forces play out?